It's Sunday morning, time for the great outdoors with Charlie Potter. Brought to you by the all-new Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio. Thank you so much for being with me this morning. It's really hard to believe that this show is the last show in August. And when I talk to you next Sunday morning, it'll be September 1st, and dove season will have opened across North America. All kinds of hunting seasons will have opened across the continent. Under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, seasons can open on September 1st, which is why the dove season opens September 1st. Canada goose season's opening. Teal season's opening soon. It suddenly becomes the time of the year when there isn't enough time, or so it seems for those of us who thrill to the rising of fish feeding for winter, or whether we love to watch the southward migration of birds. We're almost there, and I just can't, as I'm sure none of you can believe listening, where did summer go? I want to start off with, last week I was on the coast of Maine, and I talked to you a little bit. I was in Maine. I wanted just to follow up with a few more thoughts on that, as we had, again, we had a blue moon. The blue moon was rising over the Atlantic Ocean, and finally, there was some clear weather, and I had a chance to see this enormous moon. Sometimes it's called the Sturgeon Moon, which is what Native Americans called it because of its ability to illuminate holes where sturgeon live, and it's just the angle of the sun to the moon and the curvature of the earth and what happens at the end of August. But in any event, the blue moon rose, and something very bizarre happened off the coast of Maine near Portland, which hasn't happened in many, many years. Fleets of tuna boats at night, their lights blinking, could be seen far out to sea. And this is something about what's happening, as I mentioned last week, in the North Atlantic. And whether we think about it or not, Maine is indeed in the North Atlantic. It might be the gateway to the North Atlantic, going up on the Nova Scotia and Newfoundland, and ultimately all the way up towards Greenland, where, as you know, I was earlier this year. If you listen to that show on what it's like to go to the end of the earth in March, I was in Greenland. But anyway, tuna boats are now proliferating. Tuna fleets are proliferating off the eastern seaboard, and they're proliferating inshore, close enough to where recreational anglers like you and me can go tuna fishing. This is unheard of. And it goes to show us just how dynamic the ocean is and how there is no constant. And it's something we talk about a lot in the air, is there is no constant with nature. It's always in motion. It's always changing. So over a lifetime of having exposure to Maine and the eastern seaboard, tuna fishing is just not something that ever would have been on anyone's radar. And yet in the last half dozen years or more, slowly but surely, more and more tuna are showing up off the coast of Maine. They're obviously showing up because they're following bait fish. Sharks are following tuna. The whole ecosystem is moving, and it's actually migrating. I call it, it's the ocean's migration. The ocean is migrating, in this case, northward. Striped bass, a species that is very prolific off the Cape and Cape Cod and all the way down to the Chesapeake, and now can be found all the way up at the mouths of the finest salmon rivers the world has known, Atlantic salmon rivers up in New Brunswick and on through Quebec and the St. Lawrence Seaway. Striped bass are now basically wiping out the Atlantic salmon fry as they come downriver, and the striped bass are moving into these fabled rivers, the Miramichi and others. Striped bass have moved into the mouths of these rivers and, in fact, started to move upstream. Obviously, some of the pools they can't get to, they're not as powerful a swimmer as salmon, but that doesn't matter because on their way back, the salmon fry are coming downstream. And lo and behold, waiting for them are thousands, maybe tens of thousands of very hungry striped bass who are consuming the salmon fry at a level that is unprecedented in anyone's recollection. And as a result of that, we are seeing just a catastrophic decline in Atlantic salmon fisheries. And that's been going on for a number of years, but it's accelerating in many rivers due to the fact that the striped bass now are able to live in areas where they hadn't lived before. And is it a question of the water is warming? The water is certainly warmer, but it's not exactly tropical. But just a couple of degrees in water temperature apparently can mean a world of difference to fish. And striped bass are a little bit warmer species, warmer water species. And so they are moving. Even a couple degrees of water temperature is enough for them to stake out new territory. And so the Atlantic Ocean, as you're listening to me this morning, the Atlantic Ocean is, in fact, the species of the Atlantic Ocean are moving northward. And is that due to the Gulf Stream being a little closer to the continent, and therefore the waters are just a couple degrees warmer? Or is it due to other factors? Nobody knows. But what we do know is tuna are being caught where they haven't been caught. Striped bass are present where they were not present. And the ocean is indeed in a state of change. One of the things that happens like clockwork, which has not changed over time, is that sometime around the 20th of August, shorebirds begin moving south down the Atlantic Flyway. And we think of shorebirds in Lake Michigan, and we, of course, we have the piping plover that have been nesting in Montrose Harbor and the success story of bringing back the piping plover. We don't necessarily think in the Midwest about shorebirds as a mainstay of our populations, bird populations. On the East Coast of America, shorebirds are an absolute mainstay, and they come down the coast. They're coming from the Arctic. They're coming from all the way up in northern Labrador. And sometime around the 20th of August, you can just set your clock by it, and it generally is around the full moon. Here they come. And I had the pleasure last week of seeing just this migration of shorebirds, not coming down the coast. I don't mean that. I mean walking the beaches, and a beach that didn't have a sandpiper or a sanderling or any kind of shorebird on it 10 days ago now has hundreds, if not thousands, pecking away in the sand and running up and down the beach. And when they take off and fly, whether it's a plover or it's a tern or whether it's a sandpiper, when they take off and fly, it's just symphony in the air, the way they're so acrobatic and the way they turn and the wind and the waves. And it's a special time. And here we sit in Illinois and we don't think about things like that. But one thing is for sure, the southward migration has begun. It's begun on the Atlantic Flyway. It's begun already through the Midwest. We've already had the vanguard of early birds heading south, whether it be warblers or pintail or the front running of blue-winged teal. That started across the Pacific and the central flyways. Everything is already beginning as the days grow shorter. But to be on a beach, as I was in southern Maine, and just stand and watch at low tide, watch the great magnitude of shorebirds that literally arrived overnight. And they're sitting there and they're running up and down the shore. They don't swim. They're running up and down in and out of the waves. They're trying to catch, you know, microscopic vertebrae. They're picking on shells and clams. And of course, right behind them are the seagulls, chasing the shorebirds all the time, because whenever a shorebird finds something to eat, a seagull is going to be right on them and take it away. But watching seagulls pick up crabs and carry them off. But the shorebirds, when they start to take off, and they fly up and down the rolling waves of the Atlantic, just a few feet from shore, it is truly a symphony. So I had that experience as fall begins to make its presence across the continent, and Maine, being as far north as it is one of the first places it starts. So when I come back from a quick break, I'm going to talk about the Fish and Wildlife Service and a bit of a problem it has with credibility. This is not new, but it's reminding us every year of, in fact, how out of touch a governmental agency can be with its consumers, in this case, the Fish and Wildlife Service, or its clients, however you want to refer it to. But we are beholden to the Fish and Wildlife Service for a lot of data and information on migrations and birds. And when they provide information that nobody believes, it challenges their credibility. I'm also, if I have time, I'm going to talk about 26 states and the coming of referendums, what I call ballot box biology, and how it's gaining hold and continues to undermine professional wildlife management. I thank you so much for being with me. I'll be back in just a moment. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of America and Chicago, 720 WGN. And first, a message from our longtime sponsors, the Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland Chevrolet dealers.
Hiking, camping, and hunting, it's all an adventure in the great outdoors, but nature can be tough. You need to be ready for anything and everything. Chevy Silverado is built to handle the toughest conditions and get you everywhere you want to go, worry-free. Silverado's designed to handle the big jobs. It's built for the great outdoors. With over 13,000 pounds of towing capacity and trailering sway control, Silverado can haul the biggest loads on the roughest roads and keep you cool as a Sunday drive. With 8 available cameras and up to 14 different views, it can spot trouble before it gets to you. That's peace of mind. And when you're ready for the backcountry, Chevy Silverado 1500 ZR2 owns the off-road. You name it, we run over it. No wonder it's Motor Trend's 2023 four-wheeler pickup truck of the year. So see your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer or go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and check out a Chevy Silverado. It's freedom to explore the great outdoors.
It's Charlie Potter and the Great Outdoors on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio. I'm going to introduce a subject now that I will dive more deeply to in the coming weeks because it's one that, as someone who's been in the conservation field now for many, many years, is troubling. And that is data that comes out of computers from the Fish and Wildlife Service's offices in Washington that don't match up with the data that people who spend time in the outdoors are calculating with their own eyes. So the Fish and Wildlife Service last week released its breeding pairs index for waterfowl, and at the same time it did, it released its harvest information from last year. I'll talk about the breeding grounds data another time, but I'm going to focus for a moment on the harvest information. The Fish and Wildlife Service seems to believe that last year was one of the greatest years in the past 50 for success among hunters going afield when it came to waterfowl hunting. There isn't a hunter, and I know thousands of them, and have access to all kinds of hunting log records, everything which we all have access to, which is the public shooting grounds records from Illinois and any state you want. You can get that information online today. But I also am fortunate to know many individuals that keep hunting logs and may belong to clubs, of which, of course, the Fish and Wildlife Service doesn't have any data. And those numbers don't even come close to matching up with the Fish and Wildlife Service. In fact, the over a million duck hunters in North America last year would say last year was one of the poorest, if not the single poorest duck season that they can recall in memory. There obviously are always exceptions. I talked about this last December when people were singing the woes from coast to coast. And I said, by and large, this is abysmal, but there are places on the continent here in Illinois and elsewhere where populations continue to be very strong this year and seasons are great. But overall, it's a down year. In fact, it's more than a down year. Overall, it is a year where populations, due to weather and perhaps population trends themselves, the migration of waterfowl was one of the weakest we've ever seen. But the Fish and Wildlife Service, which announced their numbers the other day, said it was one of the best we've ever had. So very few people believe them. What does the Fish and Wildlife Service do in a situation like this? Well, part of it is they are using a new calculation basis. And so, as Alan often said in a post that he made on this subject, if they're going to use a new system for calculating harvest, they ought to at least compare it to the old system so that you can look at apples to apples. We don't have that ability. They gave us the new calculations. The new calculations would have you believe it was just a stellar year for migratory birds, even though a year ago, the breeding index of birds, ducks, was among the lowest it's been in decades. So the Fish and Wildlife Service, on one hand, says we have one of the lowest breeding indexes we've ever had a year ago, and then reports that we had one of the best hunting seasons we've had in the last 50 years. Though that doesn't add up even on face value. But what really doesn't add up is then you throw in the abnormally warm weather we had last fall, or maybe it's now becoming more the norm, but you throw in the warm weather that we had, which delayed the migration, and there were tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of mallards stacked up in Alberta all the way into just before Christmas. In fact, the seasons had ended in Alberta, and friends of mine were commenting they had still had ducks around. That's never happened. The season ends in Alberta and Saskatchewan because the weather shuts it down. Last year, it never shut it down, which means the birds don't come further south. And they didn't only came further south later in the year when it finally did get cold on the prairies of Canada and the Dakotas. So you can't have a poor fall flight based upon a bad breeding season and then have weather which delays the migration and enables birds to linger on the breeding grounds much longer, or at least linger along the migratory routes and disperse. And then had the Fish and Wildlife Service say it was a tremendous year. Hunting success has never been higher or worse to that effect. It doesn't add up. And not only do hunters not believe them, but people who go out watching birds, photographers, Nobody believes the Fish and Wildlife Service. So the Fish and Wildlife Service is, their data may be telling them what it's telling them, and they have a new methodology for computing the data. The problem is their constituent base, us, don't believe the data, and therefore the Fish and Wildlife Service's credibility is damaged, and I should say damaged yet once again. So in the coming weeks, we'll talk more about it, but the Fish and Wildlife Service really is out of touch with reality, at least the reality that people are seeing. They may have a statistical reality which they can verify, but the statistical reality is not matching with the visual reality of their constituents, and it's the constituents that matter when it comes to credibility. So as I mentioned at the start of the show, we have a week to go from today to the opening of seasons across America for migratory birds, and there are 26 states this fall that have some kind of referendum on their ballots about managing of wildlife. I call it, as my friend Chris Dorsey does, ballot box biology, and he's absolutely right. We are taking the management, and I've talked about this a lot, but it only seems to be getting worse. We are taking the management away from professionals and putting it into the hands of public relations campaigns and those trying to create emotion, whether it's PETA, whether it's Humane Society, Defenders of Animals, whatever it might be. These aren't scientists. These aren't people steeped in population biology on a state-by-state basis. The Colorado mountain lion ban referendum, which would end mountain lion hunting in Colorado, is just the latest example of a very high-profile one. If that were to pass in November, you can count on the population of mountain lions exploding in Colorado, and conversely, you can count on the populations of elk, deer, and antelope, and sheep crashing in Colorado. That's what happens every single time we have a ban on prey, on predator species that eat the top of the ungulate food chain. So Colorado is among 26 states that has some kind of referendum this fall, and I'm going to be out of time before I can talk about the fact that here we've had both a Republican National Convention and a Democratic National Convention. Of course, those in Chicago are well aware that we had a Democratic National Convention. And can you find the word conservation in the hundreds of hours of speeches and everything said? Not so far. I don't count global warming as a subject of conservation. So we are losing when it comes to the professional management of wildlife, and we're losing the science to people running PR campaigns and pulling on our emotions. I'll be back next Sunday morning with much more on the great outdoors. I hope you have a wonderful last week of August. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN.